Plus LLC versus Clinton Moore. Mr. Petty?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Arguing for Batteries Plus.
Yes. May it please the court, Mr. Grant, my name is Roger Pettit, and I represent Batteries Plus, the petitioner, in this matter before the court today. This case started out as a collection action brought by Batteries Plus to attempt to recover what it considered to be commissions that it had paid to Mr. Moore, which it didn't believe he deserved. We wound up, that is, Batteries Plus wound up defending a wrongful discharge action, and the scope of that is before the court this morning. Batteries Plus' position is that the articulated public policy that Mr. Moore claims was violated is not, in fact, a public policy grounded in existing law, and moreover, it believes that the trial court wrongfully allowed the case to go to the jury and denying Batteries Plus motion for judgment, notwithstanding the verdict on the issue of whether or not Mr. Moore was terminated in violation of a public policy, in other words, whether or not he was wrongfully discharged, was supported by any credible evidence or any reasonable inferences from that evidence. Section 103455 was the statute articulated by Mr. Moore at trial as the policy which Batteries Plus was supposed to have violated. 103455, however, does not discuss overpayment of wages and only requires an employer to refrain from deducting wages from an employee's check for business losses, which it claims was the employee's fault, without giving the employee an opportunity to prove that it was not his fault.
Counsel, and I just have a question.
Yes.
As I read this case, there is some similarity between this and the Bullseye Credit Laundry case occurred up in Wood County some time ago.
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar.
Yes.
Tell me, in your opinion, and I know that in the brief you've addressed this, what is the difference between, and that was different in the sense it was a check that came in and there was a bonus check and the employee was required to compensate. What is the main difference between that case in the contention that you're making here that this employee was not wrongfully terminated and that this does not affect the public policy?
Your Honor, in my opinion, in the opinion of at the wording, just using the language of the Laundry case, Laundry described what 103455 of the statutes meant, and quoting at page 329 of the Northwest Second Statute, it says as follows: we conclude that section 103455 articulates a fundamental and well-defined public policy proscribing economic coercion by an employer upon an employee to bear the burden of a work-related loss, and I'm quoting here, the highlights are starting, when the employee has no opportunity to show that the loss was not caused by the employee's carelessness, negligence, or willful misconduct. This case differs from Laundry in two primary respects. Number one, there was no deduction, there was no attempt to take any deductions from Mr. Moore's wages. And number two, the money that was requested from Mr. Moore was a retribution for damaging the company's goods or for stealing from the company or for breakage or for anything else of the kind. It was a request from Mr. Moore to give back the money that Batteries Plus felt that it had overpaid him. And so the statute, the case, in our opinion, and the public policy clearly enunciated in the quote that I just read, would separate the Batteries Plus case from laundering.
Let's take a look at the two distinctions. Let me take a look at the first of the two distinctions. The first distinction you said between this case and the laundry case is that there was no deduction from Mr. Moore's wages. Is that correct?
Correct.
Well, there was no deduction from laundry's wages either, wasn't it?
Right.
So I don't... if it is a distinction, it is certainly the weaker of your two distinctions. Is that correct?
Granted.
In fact, I'm not... let me be more bold. How can you say that that's a distinction with laundry, that is, no deduction from Moore's wages, when laundry had no deduction from wages?
Well, to answer your question fully, we have to go into the termination that surrounds it. I recognize that laundry expands wrongful discharge, and I think the rest of employers in Wisconsin recognize that laundry expands wrongful discharge when the discharge is designed to circumvent the intent of the statute. And in the one, I'm sorry.
No, please finish.
Okay. And so you have to get into the termination. And that is really the second part of the reason Batteries Plus is here today, because the termination bore no resemblance at all to the question of 103.45 applicability, because there was no denial of an opportunity by Mr. Moore to show that it was his fault or it wasn't his fault, whether wages were an issue or not.
I wanted you to finish so that I didn't interrupt you, but I wanted you to stay on the question, too. and that is your distinction with regard to number one. There was no deduction from Moore's wages. Under the statute, 103.455, you have the language that, in fact, it starts out, deductions. Mm-hmm. No employer may make any deduction. So I assume that's why you highlight that is a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
No deduction from Moore's wages. Looking at that word in the statute as part of the statutory scheme, you concede, don't you, there was no deduction in the laundry case, too.
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that first, I fully understood what you meant by that first distinction.
And in requesting money that was allegedly overpaid, we're not talking about defective or faulty workmanship, lost or stolen property, or damage to the property either. So,
that is a distinction between the two cases.
Yeah. Which two cases?
Laundry in your case.
Yes.
I mean, laundry fell within, apparently, at least some of this issue, whereas this does not.
Right.
Okay?
Yes. All right.
In both cases, though, the agreement was pay up or you're going to get fired, in effect. Isn't that make the two similar?
Well, I think Mr. Moore hopes that that's what this court will construe Batteries Plus's conduct to do, and it doesn't equate that way, because what Batteries Plus did was exactly, let's assume for a moment that the obligation of the employer and the obligation of 103.455 is to include the request for repayment of overpayment of wages, and if we deny that that's what the clear intent of the statute says, and the cases all talk about requesting repayment for losses, but just assume that Batteries Plus believed that the statute applied. The balance of the statute had to have not been complied with in order to create a termination then which was wrongful. And the statute says, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to just finish. I guess the original question, and my colleagues, I think, asked some good follow-ups. But my question was basically, now, what ended here was this was a dispute over this money, whether or not he had used his vehicle, et cetera, et cetera. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, ultimately there was a jury finding here that Moore was entitled to this money. But so there was supposedly a legitimate claim that he made, and not saying that the company's claim wasn't equally legitimate, at least at the time. But as I get the inference in reading the factual content, that he was terminated because of that matter. In other words, why isn't that similar to Wandry?
It would be similar to Wandry if the facts supported it.
Okay.
That the second part, and I can't emphasize this enough, Justice Wilcox, is that there is no evidence that this separation of employment, the termination of the employment relationship, was based upon anything other than Mr. Moore's advice to Batteries Plus, and it's exhibit 12 in the trial, and it's at the appellant's appendix at page 37. Mr. Moore, through his lawyer, advised Batteries Plus that they were unilaterally rejecting the pay as contained in the compensation program from Batteries Plus sent to him. They were unilaterally rejecting. He wasn't going to work for it anymore. Then he proposes, Mr. Moore hereby offers to be employed by Batteries Plus as a commercial sales specialist as follows. And then he states that Batteries Plus agree not to attempt to collect or assert. Now, there's a recognition that they hadn't attempted to collect any money, that they agreed not to attempt to collect any money, and then they would sign a release. His second request is that his compensation be based upon one of three of Mr. Moore's plans that he submitted to Batteries Plus. And then, I'm sorry, yes.
I'd like to follow up Justice Wilcox's question, again, for clarification. The issue as to whether or not there is an overpayment, whether or not there should have been the $12,000 paid or shouldn't have been, and whether or not it was travel expenses, that's not before the court at all, is it?
No.
That was decided by the jury in question number one of its special verdict, and you didn't appeal that,
exactly.
Is that correct? And the issue of whether or not there was some past wages due to Mr. Moore at the time that his employment ended, the jury found that there was some past wages due. The trial court adjusted the jury's amount, and that issue and facts relative to that are not before the court
either. That's correct.
I just want to make sure, because I know Justice Wilcox was, I think, talking or at least inquiring about this overpayment. That's not before the
right.
court.
No,
you've
no, it's not
appealed the jury's determination.
No, it's not.
So what we have here is concededly, as you're standing here arguing, no overpayment made.
Correct.
Thank you.
Neither was there any request by Mr. Moore to have the overpayment issue determined at the time of his employment or during his employment. The statute that he relied on at trial, 103.455, says that the employer is prescribed from taking any deductions, or if you add the Wandry overlay, can't fire someone without, as the court in Wandry says, giving the employee an opportunity to show that the loss was not caused by his fault. Now, the fault is for the loss, not for the responsibility for repayment. And I believe that the Court of Appeals didn't make that distinction, and I don't believe Moore makes that distinction either. But the statute and all the cases talk about whether the employee is responsible for the loss, not responsible for having to repay money that he didn't deserve. That has to be left up for somebody to either agree to or to be decided in a court of law. And Batteries Plus did that because Mr. Moore, while he was employed, couldn't, and while he had his advisor, which is called for by the statute, ironically, could not reach an agreement on it. Mr. Moore chose to give demands, unilateral demands, for a change in his at-will employment compensation plan going forward. And it was clear and unambiguous that that was his, that was the point that he was making, because he says, if Batteries Plus does not elect to have Clinton Moore continue to be employed as a commercial sales specialist under the above conditions, you are hereby notified that Clinton Moore will consider himself fired effective July 1st.
Counsel, I'm trying to understand your legal position before this court. As I hear it in reading the briefs, it seems to me to be your position that if an employer believes, rightly or wrongly, that an employee has been overpaid, and that employer requests reimbursement, and the employee refuses, the employer can fire that at-will employee without being subject to the wrongful termination statute.
I'm not aware of a wrongful termination statute.
I misspoke, but that's not actionable under Wandry or Brockmeyer or any case that we've had before this court.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Because the Wandry, we have to go back, if I may, to what is wrongful discharge. Wrongful discharge is a job action against an employee and violated of a public policy. Public policy well grounded in existing law. I mean, in order to understand, for employers to understand what is the public policy, it has to be well grounded in the existing law. And a reading of Wandry and a reading of Erdman, which came after Wandry, both of which discussed what the law was, 103.455 statutes, both emphasize the lack of opportunity for the employee to show the losses, and they both describe.
In other words, you are saying, I think you are conceding that this is, I think you have to concede that this is economic coercion, which is the first part of that Wandry test. What you're saying is that the second part was not met. That, in fact, it doesn't matter whether it was caused by the employee's carelessness, negligence, or willful misconduct. An employer always has the right to seek reimbursement and fire him if he doesn't.
I guess, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say yes, Justice Babbage, because even as late as the Strozinski case, it was recognized by this court that the employment at will law is still alive and kicking in this state. And the employment at will law says that an employer can fire an employee for any reason, no reason, or a morally reprehensible reason. So if you want to equate moral reprehensibility with economic coercion, then the answer is absolutely. Things like that happen all the time. Because in order to be subject to a wrongful discharge, it has to be a discharge in violation of a public policy. Now, the problem that emerged as this case went on is the public policy articulated in the trial court was the application of 103.455 to the situation in which Batteries Plus sought a return of its own money, whether it was entitled to it or not, but that's what it was. However, after the Court of Appeals decided the case, the public policy becomes Here it is. conclude that the exception to the employment at will doctrine found in section 103.455 prohibits an employer from using its coercive economic power to shift the burden of operating its business to the employee. And then they say, including the employer's overpayment of travel expenses or wages. Number one, I don't believe that that is grounded in well-established existing law. And number two, it illustrates the problem of attempting to define the wrongful discharge without grounding it in an existing law. Because taken literally, an employer, the minute he decides to hire or not to hire an employee, is using economic coercion, isn't he? Because the employer is the one with the job. The employee is the one that wants the job. Now, in the event that an employer would have overestimated his needs for the quarter and determined that, well, I have too many employees, then it terminates five or six employees. There's no cause. The employee is a good worker. There's no cause for that. That is using its superior economic power. It is using economic coercion. And where and how do we narrow that definition to what's going on? Certainly, Mr. Moore felt that he didn't owe that money, and he was justified in feeling that way. But the question is not ignoring whether the facts support a termination. The question is not whether it was morally wrong to terminate him or whether the employer disregarded his protestations. The question is whether there was a well-defined public policy that was violated.
I have a little difficulty, counsel, because of the Wandry case and our several citations to that case subsequently, most recently, I think, being last year in the Straczynski.
Yes.
It seems to me that we have a state of law that says that 103.445 does have a well-defined public policy, that it is contained in, if you will, the spirit of that statute as opposed to verbatim, and that well-defined public policy is that it prevents employers from invoking their coercive economic powers to shift the burden of a work-related loss from the employer to the employee when the loss occurs through no fault of the employee. I read that from Straczynski discussing Wandry. Now, looking at the Court of Appeals conclusion that you just read, what is it that you find to be inconsistent with the Wandry public policy found in 103.455?
The Court of Appeals decision ignores the limiting requirement that the employee have an opportunity to show that the loss was not caused by the employee's fault.
Say that again, would you, please? Yeah.
The definition of the public policy in the Court of Appeals decision ignores the limitation that Wandry has that the employee has to have an avenue for showing it wasn't his fault.
So if we included on the definition, or rather the conclusion of the Court of Appeals language, much like Straczynski, when the loss occurs through no fault of the employee, that's what Straczynski used. If we added that to the conclusion of the Court of Appeals, then the conclusion would be legally sufficient?
I think it would be an unwarranted expansion of wrongful discharge law in this state, because it is impossible to think of a situation in which the employee would be blameful except under the circumstances under 103.455, which the legislature has chosen to limit the employer's rights to use its economic power to punish an employee. because in every situation, the situation I gave earlier about needing to lay off employees because the employer screwed up in its projections for the next quarter, that's not the employee's fault. And so if that is a coercive economic decision which cost an employee his job, and it was not the, and the employee can show it wasn't his fault, under the literal reading of the Court of Appeals decision, that would be a wrongful discharge. And if that is a wrongful discharge, then we really don't have employment at will anymore. Because you have to recognize the imbalance between an employer and an employee in the relationship. But in the situation such as the as occurred in Batteries Plus, where it's not the employee's fault, and we agreed it wasn't the employee's fault, that it's an unwarranted extension of the prior case law and the construction of the statute. I want to emphasize, unless there's some more questions on that subject, but in my remaining time, my time is up. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Just complete your thought.
Thank you. I just wanted to point it out to the court, and I've done so in the brief, that there is simply no evidence available that Moore was discharged for any reason other than Batteries Plus's refusal to accept his offers to be employed under his own terms. And there, and I'm not aware of any law that says that employers have to accept the employment relationship on the employee's terms. Thank you.
So your position, this isn't a discharge at all?
Correct.
Constructive, actual, or anything else?
Correct. It was simply
taking...
Then we
get to anything else.
We took Mr. Moore up on his offer to not be employed.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Grant, representing Clinton Moore.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Attorney Richard Grant. I have a cold, so I hope I can make it through this. I'm with the law firm of Concini, Andrews, Hemming & Grant in Janesville, Wisconsin. I represent Clinton Moore, the employee respondent in this case. I have four or five responding points I think would assist the court in its deliberations, summarized very briefly as follows. First, and this point has already been made, that this is not an overpayment of expenses case. The jury found there were no overpayments. Second, that 103.455 public policy prohibits both A, firing before statutorily determined fault or liability, and B, firing where there is no fault or liability as an unfair shift of employer's cost of doing business. Third, that this court's cases of Donovan, Wandry, Erdman, Strozinski require that the statutory determination of fault or liability must precede any deduction from wages or demand for repayment. Fourth, that Clinton Moore's attorney letter of June 14, 1996 merely recognized the already existing constructive termination of his current employment while trying to renegotiate the Batteries Plus intolerable conditions that created it. And fifth, that Batteries Plus positions taken in their briefs in this case argue for a total abandonment of this state standard of review, the declared public policy under 103.455, and the Wandry line of cases under wrongful discharge law.
Let me give you a hypothetical to try to focus this in my mind. The hypothetical obviously is close, but I don't want to get these. Let's assume that there is an overpayment, that Company A overpays John Smith. And Company A demands repayment. John Smith says, wait, you've got to give me an opportunity to show that this loss was not due to carelessness, willful misconduct, or negligence, because that's what Wandry says. And so John Smith is able to show that the fault for the overpayment rested solely with Company A. It wasn't his fault at all. Are you saying that
First of all, that John Smith can keep the overpayment under those circumstances, and number two, that under no circumstances can they fire him for not paying back?
Well, first of all, I would agree with you that, first of all, it's true that if you look at the circumstances of your hypothetical, the question arises, which was discussed earlier, and that is it fault for creating the obligation to pay back or the overpayment that we're talking about? I don't think so at all. The question here is whether, and it was right from the pleadings of the Batteries Plus, the question is whether there was an obligation to pay it back. They allege in their pleading that Mr. Moore knew that he wasn't entitled to be separately reimbursed for these travel expenses, and that nevertheless he kept the money. So there is a question of fault here, and always has been, and that is whether there is an underlying overpayment and therefore creating an obligation to pay back. That's the fault. That's the loss. That's the responsibility. That's the liability, from the word in the statute, that we're talking about here. The Batteries Plus, for good reason, tried to divert that into whether or not the employee was responsible for creating
that. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. As I understand the law of employment at will in this state, an employer could say, Company A could say to John Smith, take a 15% deduction in your salary, or I'm sorry, but it's hasta la vista. An employer would be perfectly within its rights, would it not, to do that?
Yes, but the question here is whether that reduction in this case was part and parcel of the alleged constructive discharge by Mr. Moore, and whether that was part of the motivation which the jury was asked to determine as to why the termination occurred. That is, it was part of the unconscionable circumstances, the making it impossible for the employee to continue, whether that proved something about their motivation that made it a constructive discharge even before Batteries Plus actually terminated Mr. Moore on July 1, 1996. And that's what Mr. Moore says in this attorney letter, that I consider myself terminated unless you can take away these intolerable circumstances that you've put me under, particularly including paying back $12,000 of expenses that I contend were mine to begin with.
Well, it seems to me you're saying that an employer cannot compensate for overpayment unless somehow the employer can show that the overpayment was due to the employee's fault.
The employer has to show that the money was owed, that there was an overpayment. If the employee disputes the fact that there was an overpayment, as in this case, it isn't the fact that there's no remedy. There's remedies given in the statute. If there's not an agreement by the employee, then they can determine that liability in a court of competent jurisdiction, which is what they're left to.
Sure.
And that's the statute.
But they could also be left without a job.
Pardon me?
I mean, it seems to me that that Mr. Moore won here. He went to court. He doesn't have to pay back the $12,000, but he also wants a wrongful discharge determination. And
because he was terminated for that refusal.
Because he's what?
Because he was terminated for that refusal. That's exactly what Wandry is all about.
When you say he was terminated for that refusal, are you referring to the evidence offered by Moore that the employer said, if you don't pay this back, I'm going to terminate you?
Correct. To quote Mr. Rosetko by Mr. Moore, which is uncontradicted in the record, Mr. Rosetko told him, you are either going to agree to pay this money back to me, or then you are going to quit, and then I am going to sue you.
So an employer can say you take a 15% cut in pay or you're fired, but an employer can't say pay back money to me.
That's correct.
Then why not?
Because the public policy of 103.455 says that when you instruct an employee that he must pay you back something, and the employee says,
I disagree with that. I want a right to contest that because I don't think I own it, owe the money, that if you either terminate him for that refusal under wrongful discharge law or under the statute itself, if you deducted the money anyway, you would violate the public policy of 103.455.
But only if the dispute is about defective or faulty workmanship, lost or stolen property, or damage to property, not if the dispute is about overpayment of wages.
Well, it didn't mention anything about forged checks either.
But you could argue it's a loss. You could argue a loss or a theft.
Right.
Correct.
That's a loss of property.
And it's Battery Plus's theory that this was a loss, that they overpaid it, as the grade schoolers say, on accident, and that the money should therefore be paid back. Without establishing that that was true, there's no right to be paid back.
But this doesn't constitute lost property or a dispute over lost or stolen property or a dispute over damaged property or a dispute over defective or faulty workmanship, does it?
It's a loss.
That's not what the statute says. It doesn't say any business loss. The statute says defective or faulty workmanship, lost or stolen property, or damaged property.
They don't any longer have it. Why wouldn't it be lost property when they give it away when they shouldn't have, and now the employee won't pay it back? Isn't it lost to the employer?
Not in the ordinary and customary use of that phrase as it appears in the statute. Lost or stolen property. Not an overpayment. A mistaken overpayment.
Allegedly
mistaken overpayment. The statute doesn't say any business loss. You want it construed that way, but that's not what it says. And the Court of Appeals construed it that way.
Well,
that's not what it says.
I think this is a loss that the statute didn't want employers arbitrarily deducting from an employee's wages, future wages that he has a right to receive, except they're saying we're going to insist that you deduct this overpayment of your travel expenses from your future wages. And what the doctrine, as early as the Donovan case, the Donovan case said the statute authorizes deductions for losses only after it is determined that the losses were due to the employee's fault in the manner provided by the statute.
What sort of a loss was at issue in that case?
Shortages on the service station books, it says.
Okay. What about Erdman?
Pardon me?
What sort of a loss is that issue in Erdman?
Erdman sets forth an interesting example. I think that one thing I missed here, at least emphasizing to the court, is that I think there are two public policies that establish the potential for a wrongful discharge. And they begin with the Laundry case, which says there can be a situation where there is no fault. The court says at page 329, when the loss is the fault not of the employee, but of, for example, defective material or defective machine, the employer must bear the loss. Section 103.455 is aimed at preventing employers from using coercive economic power to shift the burden of a work-related loss from the employer to the employee. So what this court already said in Laundry is, if you really have a no-fault situation, a no-liability situation, like the machine came from some manufacturer and it didn't work correctly and it ruined some parts, that's a no-fault situation. That's a cost of doing business. If there were really no fault, if the fault here didn't go to the liability to pay it back, and we take Batteries Plus at their word that this is a no-fault situation, what I think the appeals court said and all of these decisions say is that then it's a cost of doing business. But that's not really what happened here. It's that Batteries Plus claims that there was fault in refusing to pay back money that they contended clearly was overpaid by mistake.
let's take a situation, and I have the same problem, frankly, as Justice Sykes does. Let's take an example where the state, could be a private employer, pays me twice a month. And suppose, and it's deposited right to my check, in my checking account. Suppose the state issues two precisely the same checks, the first of the month to me, for the last 2 weeks of salary. And there's just no question, no one can question that that one check is just error. And so then I get a call from the payroll division and says, please send back a check for this money, which is clearly error. No one disputes it. Or we're going to deduct it, or, which obviously won't apply to me, but or you're an employee at will, and we have to let you go because we can't allow for this. And I say, no deal, don't deduct it, and I don't want know if it's error or not. I really worked doubly hard last 2 weeks, and I'm not quitting, and I'm fired, okay? Am I going to be covered under 103-455?
Not the way I read the statute.
Why not? And how does it differ from your case?
Because you are not contending that fault had anything to do with it. You are not setting up the terms of the statute. The statute gives a right for the employee to contest whether or not he was at fault, whether or not he owes the money. And that's a distinction from this case. Mr. Moore always contested the fact that he had any liability for the money that the employer claimed was overpaid. That's what sets up the public policy of the statute.
I don't quite understand. In the letter from Mr. Ahrens, dated June 14, 1996, there is a reference to terms of future employment by Mr. Moore. The Batteries Plus agrees not to attempt to collect or assert any alleged overpayments of commissions. I read that as saying that they couldn't even go to court to try to determine that there was an overpayment.
Your Honor, I think I objected to this exhibit as settlement discussion. But it does clarify the point that it was always part of Mr. Moore's position that he didn't owe Batteries Plus any money. In fact, there are letters also marked as exhibit where he contends that Batteries Plus did owe him money, which the jury found. This doesn't deny separate, and this would be an agreement separate and apart from the potential for an agreed resolution of the dispute. The statute does provide not only the opportunity, but I think the requirement for the employer to determine the liability of Mr. Moore before it deducts the money from his future wages or before it demands that he pay it back or he's terminated. Don't forget that demand by the employer and then the refusal by the employee is a necessary element of both an action under 103.455 and a wrongful discharge. He has to say, I won't do it, or he doesn't have one of the elements of either claim.
Well, let me follow up on some of these hypotheticals. I'm an employer, and I overpay you $350, and I want you to pay that money back to me. And if I go to you and say, made a mistake, pay it back to me. What's an employer then to do if it's $350 and the employee says, I'm not going to agree in writing. Why should I? You know, it's your mistake. I'm not, the second step under the terms of the statute, I'm not going to agree to some kind of joint determination. Go fly a kite. And the employer says, for $350, do you think I want to take an employee to court to have liability determined and there's no criminal prosecution? Those are the three things under the statute. The written agreement by the employee, a joint determination, or some kind of court determination. So what's an employer to do in that situation?
Go to small claims court. That's what it's there for. If you won't agree. And you may agree, this is not a real likely example. If it's real clear, like Chief Justice Abramson's example, if everybody knows it's clear the money's owed, is it likely that the employee's going to start a lawsuit over that?
What difference does it make in my hypothetical, where I have the employer saying, would you pay it back? As opposed to the same facts, but the employer saying, if you don't pay it back, I'm going to fire you. How does that difference, that, if you will, coercion, that ultimatum, what difference, if any, does it make in your legal analysis?
Well, he has to say, if you don't pay it back, you're terminated to constitute a wrongful discharge.
So if he went and said, you've got to pay it back, and the employee said something in the vernacular, there is no cause of action that may be maintained by the employee once the employee is subsequently terminated for no cause at all.
Correct.
Do you mean that ultimatum? Is that what you're saying? I'm just trying to find out.
Yes, I think that's one of the elements of wrongful discharge. And you also didn't make part of your example that the employee contended that he, or disagreed with the employer's representation that he owed the money. If he doesn't take the position that he doesn't owe the money, that he's not liable for it, that he didn't cause it, that it wasn't his fault, you know, I don't think any of this stuff applies.
Well,
in Chief Justice Abramson's example, I think if he never contends that the money isn't owed by him, I think you could fire him.
I would like to go back to 14th from your client's attorney to the company. It doesn't demand that the company comply with the statute and the remedy provided in the statute, which is that the parties agree on an independent representative to decide who is at fault or go to court. It demands that the company relinquish that remedy or waive that remedy, and then further demands that the company agree to his compensation terms.
It demands that they do it to settle the case. This is an attempt by Mr. Moore to keep his job. He wanted to keep this job, but he wanted to do it in a situation where the intolerable circumstances that the employee placed upon him, we allege, because of his refusal to agree to pay it back, which is what the jury found, we allege that that's what constitutes the basis for the violation of the statute.
Right, but this was his final position in this dispute. So even assuming, for the sake of argument, which I think is a reach, but even assuming that this statute is implicated by a dispute over wages, doesn't this letter just completely blow you out of the water in terms of proof? Because he's not demanding that the remedy provided in this statute be complied with by the employer. He's demanding that the employer waive its right. And that goes well beyond what the public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine stands for.
Judge, I think you've turned the statute on its head. I think that the statute says this is one of the rare examples where the employer has any obligation to the employee before he takes a unilateral action against the employee.
And none was taken here.
There were no deductions made, and there was no termination, right?
But the action was to say by the president of the company, if you don't sign the note to pay this money back, you're out of here. You're done. You're fired. And that, if that isn't the Wandry case, you know, I can't read the Wandry case very well. I just think that that letter doesn't change a bit. That's an attempt by Mr. Moore to remove the very basis for the constructive discharge.
Counsel, this gets me to the standard of review. You have some disagreement. Your opposing counsel says the standard of review as to whether or not there's evidence sufficient to uphold the jury, that rather that issue should be looked at de novo. And you say it's any credible evidence.
Yes.
Address that issue.
What the employer does here is it wants the court to look at only the evidence it would choose, that it advances to establish its case. And that's not the standard of review. The standard of review is to, in fact, there's a point in their brief where they complain about the appeals court looking for any evidence that will support the verdict that the jury found. Well, that is the standard.
So
that's why I say they've turned the standard on its upside down. They want this court to look at only the evidence that Batteries Plus thought the jury should consider. And not only that, they only want the court to look at part of it. They only want the court to look at the part of that Attorney Aaron's letter that talks about the three alternatives where he's trying to save his job and be able to support his family. The unconscionable part of the changes in his employment status were that in a $24,000 to $26,000 job, they not only wanted him to go forward and have him pay his own travel expenses to sell Battery Plus's products, but they also wanted him to sign a document that obligated him to pay back some $12,000 or at least part of it, out of his future wages besides. That's why we pled this case and proved this case as a constructive discharge. But then when he went to work on July 1st, they also added a direct discharge. They said, you no longer have a job here.
What do I do with this case? Maybe I give you the answer before I give you the question. The answer might be waiver.
That's right. Okay,
ready? My kind of question.
The jury instructions say that there were two public policies. One is a public policy under 103455. The other public policy was under 109, that is, that the employer has to pay all wages due to employee upon severance of the employment relationship. That statute indicates that if you're a regular employee and your relationship is severed, you've got to pay within 31 days. Okay.
Yes.
The jury was instructed on that, and indeed, the jury found in answer to question 4 of the special verdict that Moore was not paid everything that he should
Correct.
Be paid. I maintain that if the jury decided this case on that public policy, that there is no possibility for a wrongful discharge cause of action. And I don't know which public policy the jury decided. It was instructed on both. What do I do with that? See, in other words,
I'm not sure I understand your point, but are you saying
this is the point that 109 pay everything within 31 days of severance. That obligation comes only after termination, and the money awarded was only because after severance they didn't pay. How can that public policy be the basis of a wrongful discharge cause of action when that public policy only comes into play after someone has been discharged or severed? I don't think it can, and I don't know from this case which the jury decided on, what public policy the jury decided on. It was given both of the instruction.
So if the employer had rules governing commissions, that the employee believed resulted in $10,000 worth of commissions that were due and owing. And the employer said, well, I'm not paying you any commissions because you're fired. Your theory is that that wouldn't violate some public policy on under...
I don't want to take too much time with this, but 109.03 sub 2, which is the policy, public policy that they were instructed on, doesn't apply to commissions. As any employee except a sales agent employed on commission basis, and here we've got salary, $24,000 plus some commission, you have to pay within 31 days. And I'm saying that I don't think that statute can be a basis of a wrongful discharge cause of action, because that statute only comes into play after someone is already discharged. And I don't know which of the two public policies, the 103455 or this one, was the basis of the jury's determination.
Well, I think that if a jury determines that an employer terminates someone to avoid paying him his wages or commissions due under the wage statute, that could be a wrongful discharge.
Let me ask this, counsel. When was your client notified about the alleged overpayments and told that he was going to have to repay them or lose his job?
In May of 1996.
You have a date?
I don't. I think there's some dispute about what day it really was.
Okay, so May of 1996. And he was an at-will employee, correct?
As determined by this jury, yes.
Okay. So if the employer had fired him in April of 1996, was it? Is that the year?
I believe so.
April of 1996, and gone to small claims court to try to collect the alleged overpayments, we would have no issue here.
Correct.
Okay, so if the employer can do that because it's an at-will employment arrangement. But the fact that it happened later is what changes the situation?
Well, no, I don't think the timing is essential. The fact that they must make a determination of liability under 103.455 before deducting it from future wages, or under Wandry commanding that he pay it or be fired, is what makes the timing critical. So they have those remedies under the statute. Get agreement, adopt a procedure where the parties are represented and you come to a conclusion about the liability, or use the courts of the state of Wisconsin to determine that liability. But as Donovan, through Wandry and all these other cases say, you must do that first, because otherwise it would be arbitrary, which is the public policy that Donovan describes from many years ago, brought forward directly into the Wandry case and cited in Strozinski. And Justice Bradley cited the quote from Strozinski I was going to refer you to that says that very thing.
You've got
to determine a liability first.
What if the company had fired him, which they can do because he's an at-will employee, for any reason whatsoever in April of 1996, and instead of going to small claims court to try to collect the overpayments, collected it out of whatever check he had coming later on?
They didn't determine the liability. As long as the employee denies the liability on the basis of a lack of a fault, if they don't go and seek that and obtain that determination first, then they can't fire him and deduct it from something else. The firing violates the standard in Wandry and the standard under Donovan, that you first must determine that the employee actually owes the money. If you turn this on its head and have an employee, and this happens a lot, where the employer comes to us in a small company to employees and says, I've got a cash flow problem. How about if I just pay you $200 each less a week for a few weeks until I can get back on my feet okay? And the employee agrees to do it. When the time is up, the employee looks at his check and it's still got that deduction on it, or it's just going back to the original amount and not paying anything back. Would it be okay for the employee to say, well, we had an agreement that he was going to pay it back, even though the employer says now, no, you agreed that I could pay you less, you know, that I'd lower your wages? And he says, no, that wasn't the agreement. Could the employee go out if this is a widget factory and load up his trunk with $800 worth of widgets as a self-remedy? I don't think so. Yet it seems that the law, even when there's a statute that says you can't do it, it seems like there's this overwhelming tendency to say, but employers should be able to do whatever they want. Well, I think this is one situation where the law requires them to do something first before they can take that unilateral, precipitous action. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Mr. Pettit?
Thank you. I just have a few brief remarks, if it pleases the court. Now, one thing that I would like to address out of order, and that is Mr. Grant's use of the term deduction from future wages. I was spacing out through most of his arguments thinking about something else, and it dawned upon me now that the characterization of the termination of Mr. Moore for refusing to work under his compensation plan is being construed today as an attempt to make a deduction from future wages. The statute, once again, upon which this public policy is supposed to be based, only requires and only forbids an employer from deducting from wages earned, not something that happens in the future. But nevertheless, future wages, it's interesting how that is construed. The Court of Appeals says that Batteries Plus could win the case if it could prove that Batteries Plus did not force Mr. Moore to waive his statutory right to contest its demand. Batteries Plus, as we've all looked at this Exhibit 12, the June 14th letter, nowhere is there a request by Mr. Moore to have a determination by Diller, which was the requirement at the time of that statute, or Department of Workforce Development now. Believe me, Justices, it would have been a lot cheaper for Batteries Plus to find out that it couldn't get that money back by having Diller sit down and talk about it than filing a lawsuit. But to go on, not only do they ask Batteries Plus to not agree to try to collect the money, that's proof that they hadn't tried to collect the money at the time, but they say you got to read our compensation plans, you got to pick one of them. Now, in the trial, there's been a lot of attempts throughout the briefing of this to claim that this was a last-minute, desperate effort by Mr. Moore to save his job. But reviewing the evidence, I don't care what level of it is, de novo or anything else, it has to be credible evidence or reasonable inferences from. And is it credible when reading Mr. Moore's letter by his lawyer to Batteries Plus saying that if Batteries Plus does not elect to have Clinton Moore continue to be employed under the above conditions, you're notified that he will consider himself fired. And one of the above conditions was that Linda Lefever, that's his supervisor, have no authority, no control, no involvement, not just with Mr. Moore, but with any aspect of the commercial sales department. Then what did Batteries Plus do? They wrote back, it's Exhibit 13, the Appendix 42, on June 28th, and they said, since Mr. Moore has unilaterally decided to refuse to work under the terms of his at-will employment, we'll consider your letter to be a voluntary election to quit. Whether you want to say it's a quit, whether you want to say it's a termination, it's a separation of the employment relationship, we will grant you that. But the question is whether it was because Mr. Moore contested his right to pay it back Or was it because Batteries Plus refused him the opportunity, as the Court of Appeals put it, to contest the repayment of the money? None of those occurred. You can't read anything else into those two pieces of correspondence other than what they say, and to try to read more into it is an unreasonable inference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pettit. That concludes 99-1319, Batteries Plus versus Clinton Mall. We are in recess.